Well, we settled kind of into a pattern here this winter where we meet here in this building on the third Sabbath of each month, and we've been had a series of potlucks and socials, and we also have established and are continuing a pattern of having a Bible study on the third Sabbath of each month. So I guess that makes this our Bible study hall. So we're going to go back into the book of Acts. We have been reviewing this book. It's an interesting one that established, in which much of the when the church was established and many precedents were set, much work was done foundationally, and the church got off to a very positive start, as we read here in these chapters in the book of Acts. We read last week, or last month, Acts chapter 15. So we're going to be picking up from there and continuing on. We've noted in the last few chapters a change in the emphasis. The first 12 or so chapters, we found a great deal about the work of especially of Peter and other of the leaders in the first few years of the church. But beginning in chapter 13, the focus began to turn to Paul and the work that he accomplished. And so that's what we'll find as we finish out the rest of the book of Acts. It primarily focuses on activities of Paul and the journeys that he took and other events that took place in his life. Of course, Christ died in 31 A.D. We have established that, and that's when the book of Acts begins, in the first chapter 2 with that Pentecost where the Holy Spirit was given and the church was begun. Just a couple of other key dates to kind of keep us a little bit in context here of the passing of time. The martyrdom of Stephen, which is recorded in Acts 7, most likely took place in 35 A.D. And that also, as you follow right directly beyond that, the story flow just continues right through in Acts 8 and 9. This was the time period during which Paul's conversion started, probably in about the year 35 or so. Now, you can go to various references, and I've mentioned this before, and you'll find maybe a year earlier or later. Then these dates that will give to you are generally to be taken as general dates, not as exact and precise. The Bible is just simply not dated that way, for the most part. But in about the year 35, Paul's conversion began. In about the year 38 is when Peter baptized Cornelius, the first Gentile convert, in the year 38. There's not a lot of detail from, it kind of jumps from that point in terms of the story flow of Acts. By the time you get to Acts chapter 13, probably you're up to about the year 48 or so. That's when Paul's first journey began, in Acts chapter 13. There's a little bit about Paul's early history. You can read in the Galatians chapter 1 and into the first part of chapter 2. In chapter 2, he mentions that after 14 years, he says, I went to Jerusalem. 14 years from 35 would bring you to the year 49, and that is the date that we believe is when the conference took place in Jerusalem that's recorded in Acts 15. During those 14 years, Paul spent some time being directly and specifically taught by Jesus Christ. It also says that he went into the northern regions of Syria and Cilicia, where he was working with the churches in that region prior to his trip, which took him on his first journey, which we understand to have been in the years 48 through 49, and are covered in Acts 13 and 14. So as we come to chapter 15, which we were where we were last time, the conference at which the decision was made regarding the Gentiles, that is, that it was not necessary for them to be baptized in order to receive salvation. That conference took place in the year 49. We'll just glance back just for a moment at the beginning of chapter 15. In chapter 15, verse 1, says that certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Therefore, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and others would go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders about this question. So the work that Paul and Barnabas had done in the area of Antioch, where they were based at this point, and also into Galatia. Remember, on the first journey, they established churches in Lyconium, Lystra, and Derbe. And when they traveled through those areas, of course, it was a Gentile area, and many Gentiles were baptized. And the question among the Jews then was, well, why are they not being required to be circumcised? Paul and Barnabas obviously did not require that of the Gentiles as they were being baptized when they were on that tour through Galatia. That's why these people came from Judea into the area where Barnabas and Paul were to teach that they needed to be circumcised. Well, that's what led then to the conference that is described here through most of the rest of this chapter. And again, the decision was made that it was not necessary for them to be circumcised. When that decision was reached, we read a little later in the chapter, we could pick it up in verse 32, that Silas and Judas had returned with Paul and Barnabas to the area of Antioch to deliver this decision, to explain it to the Jews in that area and the Gentiles, who had been troubled by those who were trying to force circumcision upon them. Judas and Silas were prophets. They exhorted and strengthened the brethren, that is, in the area of Antioch, with many words. After they had stayed there for some time, they went back with greetings from the brethren to the apostles. There does not seem to have been any serious difficulty with the decision itself. There was, of course, a lot of personal antagonism between Jews and Gentiles that took many years to overcome, as referred to often in the New Testament in Paul's writings. But in terms of questioning the doctrinal decision, that does not seem to have been the case. Judas in particular, went back to Jerusalem and with greetings from the brethren to the apostles. So they seem to have been accepting of the decision. Silas remained there in Antioch. Paul and Barnabas also remained in Antioch, teaching the word of the Lord with many others also. Then, verse 36, after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we've preached the word of the Lord and see how they're doing." So this chapter 15, verse 36, marks the beginning of Paul's second journey. The first one was recorded in Acts 13 and 14. Now begins the second journey, and they start by retracing their steps back through the churches they had already established to encourage them and to give them further instruction and just to see how they're doing. Drop down to verse 41. Well, verse 40, Paul chose Silas and departed, and he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Syria is where Antioch was located, so he started there in the immediate area. Cilicia is the region just to the west of Syria. The area of Syria is basically where the nation of Syria is today, and then to the west of there, along the coastline of the Mediterranean, was the region of Cilicia. So that's where Paul started this journey. So we're going to continue description or talking about that journey as we continue on into chapter 16. And I'm going to ask for some help here. These maps trace Paul's journey, or this map that you're receiving traces Paul's second journey. I gave you one last time that was a map of showing his route on his first journey. This one will begin in Antioch, which is closer to, it's on the right-hand side of your map, about halfway down, is the city of Antioch, north of the area marked Phoenicia. This is the Antioch where Paul and Barnabas were located. If you look at that map, you follow the line there that hugs the coastline. It goes to Tarsus, and then further west from there, the area around Tarsus would be Cilicia. So they started there in Syrian Antioch and then traveled over to Tarsus in Cilicia, and from there continued on their journey. So as we begin then in chapter 16, it says, then he came to Derbe and Lystra. So he's finished his journey through the areas of Syria and Cilicia. He came to Derbe and Lystra. These were churches in the just on the edge of a region called Galatia, which I had given you a map previously, which indicated those cities would be in that region. Derbe, Lystra, and Iconium all are in the southern area of Galatia. And behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. He was well spoken of by the brethren who were at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted to get him to go with him. Paul wanted Timothy to travel with him. And he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region, for they all knew that his father was Greek. So we find here our introduction to Timothy. He's a man who was very young at the time, apparently, when Paul met him. And Paul considered Timothy to be his son, spiritually speaking. And Timothy certainly looked to Paul as a mentor. We find two epistles written to Timothy at the very end of Paul's life to encourage Timothy, who clearly went on to become one of the ministers of the church in that time. But this was when they first began to work together. It says that Timothy his father was Greek and his mother was Jewish. Under Jewish law, the son would take the mother's religion. It was the mother's responsibility, and she would determine the religious training of her children. So with that, then, Timothy, you would think, would have been circumcised on the eighth day. However, under Greek law, the father dominates the home. So in this case, with this mixed marriage, with the Greek father and the Jewish mother, the father apparently, or obviously, did not allow his newborn son to be circumcised. We don't know what kind of a person his father was, and nothing else is said of him. He's not mentioned here any further, or in Timothy, where Timothy's grandmother and mother are both mentioned by name. Could be that Timothy's father died when Timothy was very young. It also may be that although he didn't allow his son to be circumcised, he did allow his wife, Eunice, to teach Timothy, because we do find in 2 Timothy 3 that he knew the scriptures from childhood. So two possibilities. Either his father had already died and was no longer on the scene, or he was at least allowing his wife, or Timothy's mother, to school him, to teach him from the scriptures, from the Hebrew Bible. Whatever the situation may have been, Timothy never had been circumcised. So that created a dilemma. Timothy was a respected part of the Jewish community through his mother, but even though he was well spoken of, as we see in verse 2, He could never fully be accepted by the Jewish community because he wasn't circumcised. For example, he could not be a full member of the synagogue. Even Gentiles, when they were proselytes, had to be circumcised. And so while Timothy was obviously a talented and respected young man, he was not really part of the Jewish community because he had not been circumcised. Now, based on the conference that is described in the previous chapter, we know that it was not necessary for him to be circumcised to receive salvation. That is not what this is about. He was circumcised not because it was required of him for salvation, but because of the Jews, it says, who were in that area. Paul, of course, when he would travel, would stop in synagogues to preach the gospel to the Jews and to present the gospel give them the opportunity to become part of the church. And so Paul, in order to make it easier for Timothy to take part in the work that he was doing, found that it was expedient for Timothy to be circumcised so that he'd be acceptable to the Jewish community. He could be fully a part of it. It wasn't necessary for salvation, but it was a logical step for them to take so that Timothy could be more effective in his ministry with Paul. Verse 4, as they went through the cities, they delivered to them the decrees to keep, which were determined by the apostles and elders at Jerusalem. So again, it's kind of ironic in a sense that they were delivering the message that it was not necessary to be circumcised to receive salvation, even though Timothy had just been circumcised. But again, understand the reason for that. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and increased in number daily. So it was a time of growth, of rapid growth in the church. And we'll see some evidence of that rapid growth as we look at Paul's travels through a few of the cities here in this next chapter or two. The people were strengthened in their faith, in their confidence, in their obedience, and numbers were increasing. It was a very positive period of time in the church. And this would have been about the year 50. The second journey of Paul, most would date between the years 50 and 54. So following the conference, they returned to Antioch. They were there for, it says, a number of days. And then this second journey began in about the year 50. So this was a time then, 19 years after Jesus had died, and a time of still of rapid and steady growth and stability among the members. There were challenges, there were trials and persecution, but the church itself was stable. Now, verse 6, when they had gone through Phrygia and the region of Galatia, they were forbidden by the Holy Spirit to preach the word in Asia. You see on your map that if they started in Antioch, traveled through Tarsus, and there, as we just read, they were in Derbe and Lystra. These are the churches in southern Galatia. And Paul, as you see the route traced, had his eyes on going north into this region of Asia, or what we would call Asia Minor, and currently the nation of Turkey. And he was headed to a city, you see here, called Dorylaeum. Verse 7 says, after they had come to Mysia, they tried to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit did not permit them. God made it clear, it doesn't say how, but through the Holy Spirit, that Paul was not to go in that direction. God did not intend for Paul to go on further north into that area of Asia, but he had something else in mind for him. So verse 6 says he was forbidden. Verse 7 says the Spirit didn't permit them. So in one way or another, led by the Holy Spirit, they understood that that was not where they were to go. So passing by Mysia, they came to Troas. See, Troas is right on the coast of the Aegean Sea, In the northern part of that area of Asia Minor, as it's called, or Turkey. So they came to Troas, and from there they had to get across the Aegean Sea, that little corner of it there, to get over to their destination. Verse 9 says, "A vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia stood and pleaded with him, saying, 'Come over to Macedonia and help us.'" So here we see in just a couple or three, we see in just a few verses, three instances of God using a supernatural way to communicate to Paul. He was forbidden by the Spirit to go to Asia. The Spirit would not let him go into Bithynia. And by this dream or vision, he was told that where he was to go was Macedonia. So this was these are examples of God revealing his will to Paul under these circumstances. Verse 10, "Now after he had seen the vision, and immediately we sought to go to Macedonia, concluding that the Lord had called us to preach the gospel to them. Therefore, sailing from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace, the next day to Neapolis." Notice the change in the way it's written here. In the previous verses, take verse 7, for example, it says, they had come to Mysia, they tried to go to Bithynia. Verse 8, they came down to Troas. But then, as we get to verse 10, it says, we sought to go to Macedonia. That God had told us to preach the gospel, we ran a straight course. What's happened here is that Luke has now joined the traveling party. Before that, when he's speaking in the third person, he's talking about what he knew, what he had learned, and he was recording that history. But here in verse 10, he says we and us. So he's speaking in the first person. So it's at this point that Luke begins to travel with Paul. There's no explanation as to why he wasn't there before or why he joined them. We just see from the way that the book is written that was the case, that Luke began to travel with them. Verse 12, "And from there to..." Now, this is a city that I'm having trouble naming, okay? I have always, all of my life, all 34 years or so, all of my life, I have known this city as Philippi. I've recently, through some lectures I've heard from those who are instructors at the Foundation Institute, have learned that this is properly pronounced Philippi. Now, I would have a little bit of question about that. Then how come it didn't write the epistle to the Philippians? How come it's the Philippians? At any rate, I'm trying not to rebel against my instructors. Apparently, the proper Greek pronunciation is Philippi. There's a city in West Virginia just south of Morgantown, or south of Moundsville, called Philippi. Now, I'm glad they didn't go quite that far. It's spelled the same as this, but they pronounce it Philippi. So I'm going to try to refer to this city as Philippi. Excuse me if I lapse. At any rate, that's where they headed. They came to Philippi, which is the foremost city of that part of Macedonia, a colony, and we were staying in that city for some days. Notice he's still we. Luke is still immediately traveling with the party. Macedonia is a region you see on your map. It's at the top land mass that's labeled there. It's actually in northern part of Greece. The city's below that. In that general vicinity were parts of Macedonia. We don't know. I'm not that familiar with this part, this geography of this region, but just north of Macedonia, which is the northern part of Greece, you would find the nations of Bulgaria, Albania, and Serbia. So it's just the eastern part of Europe. And so it's significant that at this point, The gospel is taken now for the first time onto the continent of Europe as they go into Macedonia. Philippi is a major city. It's at the juncture, of course, of these two continents of Asia and Europe. It says that it was a colony, and that is significant. A colony was a particular designation for a city that was considered an outpost of Rome itself. It was actually considered to be part of the territory of Rome because the designation of colony, an important city in the eyes of the Romans for various strategic and commercial reasons, and so it was designated a colony. There were not that many colonies, and it was important to Philippi to have that that status or that designation. So they were therefore citizens of Rome and had all the rights of Roman citizenship. With that in mind, as you next time you read through the book of Philippians, you can look for the theme of citizenship. Citizenship is a theme in that epistle. Paul speaks of the requirement or the importance that as Christians they be good citizens and to live in a proper way to represent the gospel. This is the letter where Paul wrote that our citizenship is in heaven. So the concept of citizens or citizenship was what really rang a bell with those in that city because of the status they had as being a Roman colony. On the Sabbath day, it says in verse 13, we went out to the city to the riverside where prayer was customarily made, and we sat down and spoke to the women who met there. That seems like kind of an odd event, but actually fits well with what we know about Judaism in that day. The Jewish religion required that if there were 10 Jewish men in a city, that they would establish a synagogue. If there were 10 or more men in a city, they were required to establish, to set up a synagogue. If there were fewer than 10 men, then they would establish a place of prayer. And that's where they would gather on the Sabbath day. And they would usually set this place of prayer near water for the purpose of ritual washings that they would participate in. So it's based on that then, it seems logical. Remember, Paul always went to the synagogue to preach. So it doesn't say anything about that. Apparently there was no synagogue in Philippi. And so he found, maybe he had to ask around a bit, but he located the place of prayer that was used by the Jews. And he spoke to the women who met there. Doesn't say that there were any men present at all. There may or may not have been. There certainly were not enough to establish a synagogue. And it would not be hard. They would be able to find each other under those circumstances and determine their common understandings. So they began to speak with these people. Verse 14, a certain woman named Lydia heard us. She was a seller of purple from the city of Thyatira who worshipped God. The Lord opened her heart to heed the things spoken by Paul. This is a woman who was from Thyatira but was living in Philippi. Thyatira was on the opposite side of the Aegean Sea. Remember, it was one of the seven churches that were a circuit that are described in Revelation 2 and 3. If you look on your map, remember, you see they crossed over the Aegean at Troas. Just south of that is the city of Pergamum. And Pergamum was also one of those seven cities where the letter was sent to the churches. Thyatira was just south and east of Pergamum, about 40 miles from Pergamum, about 40 miles southeast. Now, this region where Pergamum and Thyatira are located, I'm not sure how far it extended because it's not labeled on the map, on this map, but this general region was called Lydia. And so it seems that, or is likely that, the woman that they met was not actually named Lydia, but that she was from the region of Lydia, which is where the city of Thyatira was located. Some speculate that this woman may have been one of the women that was mentioned in the book of Philippians. The letter to the church at Philippi includes a reference to two women, Euodia and Syntyche. And these were women, chapter 4, verse 2, who were leading women in the congregation, but who had a dispute, and then Paul was urging them to reconcile. So there's some speculation that that may be who this woman was. She may have been one of those two. But that all is just speculation. Now, the city of Thyatira was known for its expensive purple dyes and its purple clothing. So it could be that she somehow made the clothes or had the clothes made in Thyatira, and she was a merchant living in Philippi selling the clothes. It doesn't mention what that connection is, but that she was a seller of purple identifies her as someone who worked with those purple dyes and fabrics and clothing that the region was known for. Here again, there's no mention of a husband, so it's likely she either was a widow or was never married at all. In the region of Macedonia, where she lived here in Philippi, this part of the Roman Empire extended, because of the culture of the area, women had more rights and more independence and more privileges than they did in other parts. Those were dominantly Jewish. So she would have had the opportunity, the freedom to have a to operate her business and in that kind of a setting or situation. So God opened her heart to heed the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household were baptized, she begged us, saying, "If you've judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay." So she persuaded us. So this is an indication that she was a wealthy woman. She had a house that was large enough to accommodate this traveling party. And she had a household. Perhaps she had children. And if she was a widow, maybe she had servants living in her home. Doesn't say who was in the household, but she was supporting a number of people. So this is an indication of her wealth. Now we're going to see in the next, through this chapter and the next one, a number of cases where it seems as if people were almost instantly converted. And we need to recognize that that's not the point we should take from it. That kind of a view or reasoning is what leads some, more in the Protestant world, to the conclusion that all you have to do is just in a very short time, maybe in one meeting, you learn about the Lord and you accept the Lord in your heart, and that's all you have to do. But in each case, we'll see that the people that are converted, and we'll see several three examples of it here, that they had a background and an understanding of God's truth. This woman, whoever she was, the woman either named Lydia or from Lydia, had a background in the Jewish religion. She was practicing that religion. And in these cases, what they needed to understand was that Jesus was the Messiah. They already knew and understood and were practicing other elements of the religion. And so when God opened her heart to the things spoken by Paul, in other words, she realized that Jesus Christ was her Messiah. And in a relatively short time, then after that, there was some apparent teaching, and who knows what happens between verses 14 and 15, she is baptized and her household with her. But I think the point for us to recognize and to remember is that being baptized is something that a person must be prepared for, so that they understand the commitment they're making, they understand what repentance is, and they understand the relationship that they need to have with Jesus Christ. And while that is not spelled out here in detail, we should not take it as some kind of an altar call type situation where a person just an emotional state or very quickly without any real background can be baptized or receive God's Spirit. Verse 16, as it happened as we went to prayer, that a certain slave girl, possessed with a spirit of divination, met us, who brought her masters much profit by fortune-telling. Now, there's an implication here of the passing of time. It doesn't say how much time. It doesn't say how long they stayed at the home of this woman. We just don't have a sense of how much time has passed. But as it happened and as we went to prayer, certainly indicates some kind of a passing of time. So we find that there is a church that is established in Philippi, and we don't see a lot of detail of how it was established. But while he was there, this woman and her household became the first members of that congregation, and others, we'll see, were added. So over a period of time, while they were there, there was an occasion as we went to prayer. Now, maybe they were headed back down to the river again on a Sabbath day. Doesn't say exactly what they were doing, but that's what we had seen back in verse 13. But as we went to prayer, a certain slave girl possessed with the spirit of divination met us, who brought her masters much profit by fortune-telling. This girl followed Paul and us and cried out, saying, "These men are the servants of the Most High, who proclaim to us the way of salvation." And she did this for many days. It went on and on and on. Wherever they went, this woman would show up, almost like she was stalking them. And she would cry out to the people this message, that these are the servants of God and they've come to proclaim to us the way of salvation. What's wrong with that? A little free publicity. Well, it was something that just became very distracting. The people were aware that this young woman was one who was known to be possessed by a spirit, and she was known to be someone who was strange and odd, and wherever Paul went with his traveling party, that there she was crying out in this way. And it wasn't really her, it was the voice or the message of a demon. And Paul put up with it for a period of time, but after many days, this was not something that Paul was pleased to have as a distraction. It says, Paul, greatly annoyed, turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her," and he came out that very hour. Greatly annoyed literally means worn out. He just had enough of this distracting, obnoxious voice crying out in the background and making it difficult for him and for him to deliver his message. The way Paul dealt with the Spirit was in the name of Jesus Christ. Obviously, we as humans don't have authority over the spirit world. Jesus Christ does. So he asserted the power of Jesus Christ, and the demon then obeyed and came out of her because of, Paul certainly was an apostle and one who was led by Jesus Christ, but it came out of the woman in the name of or by the power of Jesus Christ. Verse 19, when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, see that they just were using this woman. She had this, what they called a spirit of divination. The spirit of divination, if you look it up in the lexicon, literally means a python spirit, like the snake, a python spirit. In Greek mythology, a mystical serpent guarded the temple of Apollo. Of course, Satan is a serpent, and so that symbol kind of follows through and follows him a lot. So they had this a serpent, mythical or mystical serpent, guarded the temple of Apollo, and this python spirit became a description of one who was possessed by a demon, one through whom this snake, this python, would speak. So that was the origin, and that was the background that the people there were aware of, And certainly another reason why Paul didn't want that influence where he was trying to deliver the message of the gospel. But her masters were angry because now they'd lost their source of income because they had used her to do fortune telling and things of that nature. And so because of that, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to the authorities. In the central part of these cities was a marketplace, and it was where commerce was conducted and also where the civic leaders would meet to make decisions and to render judgments. So they dragged them to the marketplace to the authorities. And they brought them to the magistrates, and they said, "These men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city and teach customs which are not lawful for us, being Romans, to receive or observe." Now, what they really were upset about was that they'd lost their source of income. So they made up this accusation against them. But the accusation was based on Roman law, actually. When the Romans came into a region, they allowed the areas that they conquered, the people in those areas, to continue in their own religions. They didn't force them to change their religion. However, under Roman law, it was not legal to introduce a new god or a new religion. And so these people were accusing Paul of breaking that law, as Romans, they were not allowed, and again, in Philippi, they were Roman citizens, but they were not allowed to receive the teaching of a new god or a new religion. This was a significant moment. If a decision was rendered by these magistrates that Paul was indeed introducing a new god and a new religion, then he would have been forbidden from teaching the gospel any place in the Roman Empire. And so that was the attempt that was being made here. If that had been the decision, then that would have had a great impact on his work. So we'll see how it plays out. The multitude rose up together against them, and magistrates tore off their clothes and commanded them to be beaten with rods. And when they had laid many stripes on them, they threw them into the prison and commanded the jailer to keep them securely. So they were beaten. It's hard to read or hard to understand just from reading these words how brutal the beating was. They were laid, many stripes were laid on them through a brutal Roman beating. And then they were thrown into the prison. And the jailer was told to keep them secure. So having received such a charge, he put them into the inner room and fastened their feet in the stocks. And when he says they and them, apparently it's referring to Paul and Silas. Here Luke is not saying we. So he apparently was not part of this particular instance when this beating took place. But the jailer put them into an inner prison, or the inner prison, and fastened their feet in the stocks. Now, the jailer was given a very important responsibility. He was told to keep them securely. That was a very strict command given to him, that he was to be sure that nothing happened to, and that these prisoners, and that they certainly would not escape. So he put them in a very secure location. The inner prison was an interior cell in the prison building facility, an inner cell with no windows, no light, no ventilation. It was just like a closet. It was with no way for them to escape. Not only were they put in this interior room, but they were fastened with chains. He put them in and fastened their feet in the stocks. The stocks were these wooden forms that they would put their ankles into, and then they would be secured around them so that they couldn't walk. But in addition, their legs were spread out as much as possible, so there was a very painful and very awkward position that they were left in. So I would say that the jailer made them pretty secure, the way he handled the situation. He was going to be sure that he would not be to blame if anything happened to these men. Then at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Well, the prisoners probably had no choice. Now, they may have been in a different room, in a more secure location, but they were all prisoners in this jail, in this prison. And they're all probably, you know, miserable and upset and hurting. And here are these two morons in the middle of the night singing hymns. And so they were listening. There are many psalms that were set to music, and I'm sure that they were traditional in that time that they knew, and they would hymns that praised God and also were prayers for his strength and his intervention. So as this is taking place, suddenly there was a great earthquake. Earthquakes are common in this part of the world. It's a very seismically active area still. And so there was a big earthquake. So that the foundations of the prison were shaken, and all the doors were opened, and everyone's chains were loosed. I've been through a couple of pretty good earthquakes, pretty sizable in their strength, and I can imagine that a door frame can be twisted and maybe a door can pop open as a result of an earthquake. But it would be a really unusual earthquake that would make everyone's chains fall off. So obviously this was a supernatural intervention that all of their chains were popped loose for all the prisoners when this earthquake took place. The keeper of the prison awakened from his sleep and seeing the prison doors open, supposed the prisoners had fled and drew his sword and was about to kill himself. See, the jailer had this responsibility. He was to watch over all the prisoners, but especially those two in particular, and they were to be kept securely. And nothing, he was responsible for their remaining in custody. As a result of the earthquake and the damage done and the doors being opened, he just assumed, and who wouldn't, that everyone would head for the hills, would get out of that prison. But he was responsible. This was actually according to something called the Code of Justinian, any guard who allowed his prisoners to escape was liable to receive the same punishment that the prisoners were sentenced to. Maybe this tells us that Paul and Silas were sentenced to be executed. I'm not sure. But certainly the jailer took upon himself that responsibility for, in assuming that they had escaped, that his life would be in jeopardy anyway. He was about to kill himself. It seemed the honorable thing for him to do. So Paul called out with a loud voice, saying, "Do not do yourself no harm, for we are all here." We're all here, even the other prisoners. And who knows why they didn't all run for it. Obviously, again, it's a supernatural situation. All of the prisoners were still there after they had been released or set free from their chains by this earthquake. So then the guard called for a light, and he ran in, and he fell down trembling before Paul and Silas. And he brought them out, and he said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" So here's another example, just like we saw a little bit ago, but with Lydia, the woman from Lydia. Or maybe she was Lydia, I don't know. But this other woman, who in a similar way seems to have been baptized almost immediately upon finding out or learning. But again, put this in the greater context. The jailkeeper was a part of their local community and their religion and their society. But he had been in this area, Paul and Silas had been in the area for quite some time by now. They had gone throughout the city preaching the gospel, and this man was very likely one who had heard of that message. There had been miracles that had taken place. The demon-possessed woman was dealt with, and so this man had some experience with Paul and Silas, what they were teaching, seen them in action most likely, and now certainly was directly affected by this supernatural event. And so he, based on what he'd experienced and what he had learned, turned to Paul and Silas and realized there was something special about these men and their message. And so he was converted. But again, it wasn't just something that happened instantly, that without any basis for or time for learning and for coming to an understanding. So they answered him. They said, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him. So they not only told him you have to accept and believe on Jesus Christ, but they also preached to him the message of Jesus Christ. And so when they had done that, then that same hour of the night, he took them that same hour of the night and washed their stripes, and then he and his family were baptized. It happened quickly, yes, but again, it's not emotional answer to an altar call and just simply accepting the Lord into your heart. We know that baptism leads to a process of conversion, and that's what this man and his household, his family, were led into. He brought them into his home. He set food before them, and the household rejoiced with him. So, then interesting turn here. The magistrates learned what had happened. And the magistrates sent officers to the jailer. They apparently learned of the events, the earthquake, the breaking of the chains, and so on. And so they sent through these messengers to the jailer and said, just let him go. Just kind of dismissed it. Kind of an impersonal, as if nothing had ever happened, sort of a solution to the situation. Just send them on their way, as if they were just hardly worth trifling with and nobody of any importance. So the message was sent. Now you might think, well, that's good news. Okay, well, the magistrates said that we can go, we're free, the charges have been dropped, there's not going to be any repercussion from this. So the keeper of the prison reported these words to Paul, saying, "The magistrates have sent to let you go." They sent the message. "Now therefore depart and go in peace." But Paul said to them, "Look, this isn't going to cut it. This is not right. They have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans, and thrown us into prison." See, there's something about Paul and Silas that these magistrates didn't know. They did not realize. They assumed that these men were not Roman citizens. Most of the Jews were not Roman citizens. Paul, as we know, was born in Tarsus, and he was a Roman citizen. So Paul said, "Look, they can't treat us like this. We are Roman citizens." As a matter of fact, it was a capital crime to beat a Roman citizen who had not been convicted of a crime. So these men now were liable for a death conviction, or that they could have been killed for what they had done to these Roman citizens. So Paul says, "Look, they have beaten us openly, uncondemned Romans, and threw us into prison, and now they put us out secretly. Now they treat us as like we're just little trifles in the way. They just dismiss us, go on, go on, go on. No, indeed. Let them come themselves and let us go." Paul was a courageous little guy. As a Jew, he probably was not tall in stature, and apparently even slight in build, as we learn about him in other places. But he was, in this case, standing up for the church at Philippi so that they would be treated properly in the future by these officials. If he just quietly gone away, kind of an unconvicted yet charged with these charges hanging over them, that would have been something that would have put the rest of the church in jeopardy in the future. So Paul refused to leave until things were set straight. So now they take a different tone. They've realized, oh, this was a Roman citizen. You know, and they realize the potential trouble that they are in. And the officers told these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. So then the magistrates came and pleaded with them and brought them out and asked them to depart from the city. Now they were shown some respect. Now these civic leaders came to the jail and asked them to please leave and to depart from the city. So when they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia, and when they had seen the brethren, they were encouraged, or they encouraged them, and then they departed. So again, doesn't say here how long Paul and Silas were in Philippi. But by the time we get to verse 40, there are other brethren besides Lydia. There are others that are part of now this new congregation. When you read Philippians chapter 1, verse 1, you see there that there are elders and deacons in the church at Philippi. Whether they were all established here at this point is not clear, but it had become an established congregation. It wasn't just it had been set up and been established. Okay, I'm not going to get through too much more, but let's just start chapter 17 and go a little bit into here, see Paul's experience then in Thessalonica. So after they left Philippi, they went to Thessalonica, and you see that on your map. It's about 100 miles or so southwest of Philippi, also a major city in the region, population of about 200,000 at the time of Paul. So they passed through the region and they came into this area. Verse 2, Paul, as his custom was, went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures. Now we often use this verse or others like it as proof that the church continued to observe the Sabbath after Jesus' death. I think we can use it that way, at least among ourselves. We understand that this is an example of Paul observing the Sabbath. However, it also is an example of the method or the custom of Paul when he went into a city. And he would go where the Jews were, which would be in the synagogue on the Sabbath. So it's not a strong proof of the church continuing to observe the Sabbath. I think it is something that we would say supports that understanding. But we have to be careful not to use a verse that others could turn around and show that it could have another meaning when we're trying to prove something from Scripture. So he went to the synagogues, and he explained and demonstrated that Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. So he preached the lesson of Jesus Christ, that he was the Messiah, that he was killed, and that he was resurrected. Some of them were persuaded, verse 4, and a great multitude of devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women joined Paul and Silas. So the people became convicted, some did, and the church, again, we see the foundation of another church being formed here among some of the devout Greeks and some of the leading women in the area who were among the first members of that church, of that congregation. But the Jews who were not persuaded became envious and took some of the evil men from the marketplace and gathered a mob and set all the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason and sought to bring out the people. So these were stirred up. There were those who were not, who did not accept the message. The marketplace, again, the central part of the city where commerce was done and where leaders would meet and gather. So they put together a mob and they attacked the house of Jason. Jason was apparently a member of that local synagogue that Paul had gone to, and it was known that he had become a believer, and the angry mob felt or thought they would find Jesus at, or Paul, find Paul and Silas at his home. They didn't find him. They dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city and cried out, "Those who have turned the world upside down have come here too." That's a statement I'm sure you've read before and heard mentioned, expounded. A couple of things to note from that. First of all, the work of that Paul was doing, the knowledge of what he was doing had spread throughout the region. They said that the same thing we've heard of happening elsewhere is happening here too. And also the perspective that they are turning the world upside down. We, of course, understand that the truth of God's way turns things right side up. People are living upside down, and they don't know it. And when things get turned around, then to get set straight, then to them that seems upside down. So the charge was laid against them. Jason has harbored them, they accused, and these are all acting contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus. So they twisted the message of the gospel to make it seem as if these people were somehow being disloyal to Caesar, and that Jesus was a king, and they made it seem as if this is some kind of a seditious movement against Caesar. Obviously just twisting and exaggerating and misrepresenting the gospel. So they troubled the crowd and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. So people were stirred up and concerned because they believed that the accusations were true. So when they had taken security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. This implies that Jason and those with him had to pay some kind of a bond to prove that they were, or to agree that they were willing to go to find Paul and Silas, because this mob couldn't find them, and to be sure that they left. It was some kind of a deposit, or some kind of some money, or maybe his property, or whatever, that was held against him until he fulfilled what they had sent him to do. And they took that security, and they agreed to find them. Then the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. So after this had been established, then they realized that this was not a safe place, that this mob was serious, and that Paul and Silas would need to leave the area. So they sent them away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, they went straight back to work. They went to the synagogue of the Jews. And so the church in Thessalonica apparently was formed by those, as it says in verse 4, the multitude of devout Greeks and some leading women, and Jason representing some of those who had been in the synagogue where Paul had gone. These became the core of the congregation that was established in Thessalonica. And we'll see next time that Paul wrote his letters to the churches at Thessalonica during this second trip that he was on. That brings us to a section that I think we cannot finish in just 5 or 10 minutes, so we're going to stop right there. And we will talk next time, begin here with what happened when they were in Berea. And from there, they went on as well to Athens and then to Corinth. They covered a lot of territory, and much of the work of the church was established and accomplished during this 4-year period of time when Paul was on what is generally considered his second journey. So that's where we will stop for today, and we'll pick it up there the next time we have a Bible study.